couldn't help but, when you see these young children coming in, I couldn't help but realize that when I was pastoring over here, my children were that size. And, of course, now Kevin's 18 years old and 6'2", and Gigi is about 5'5", and 17-year-olds. And it's, time does go on. Some of us don't change, but the rest, some of you do. And it really takes you back. It was so nice this morning for me to see the snow, because I hadn't expected to see quite the wonder winterland that you have. And of course, it really took me back when I used to sit together with my family on a Friday night and have the fireplace going, and we're just sitting on the floor and, you know, usually popping corn or something like that. And there's nothing quite as sort of family-oriented as to have snow falling outside and then to be warm and cozy inside and the whole family together and with the fire. So I was talking to my wife last night on the telephone, telling her about it. I said, I don't know if I can revisit this area too often. It gets to me. So she said, well, you know, you live in the past. And so it really is nice to come through. I try when I can. I like to get out about once a month and make at least two church visits. And I was in Kansas City Thursday, and it seemed to tie in real well. I'm going to go, of course, to Sarnia this afternoon. I've never even been to Sarnia since it's been a church, so I'd like to visit there. So I'll have an opportunity to do that. How many of you remember Mr. Manteuffel? Okay, well, I was just with him Thursday, and he just wanted me to certainly give regards from he and his wife. And rather interesting, his little boy, that Dan, that he had now, is one of the star basketball players in the whole city of Kansas City. So, you know, that's rather amazing to see those things happening. And then also I got to talk to Dennis Pyle and, of course, the other pastor there, Brian Hoyt. So everybody says to extend a welcome. Of course, Mrs. Boaz. How many remember Mrs. Boaz? Well, of course, she's been my secretary now for about 6-7 years, and very hard worker, and she certainly wanted me to extend her greeting as well. So if I can think of a few others who told me, Bob Ellsworth, our perpetual bachelor, who's a 32-year-old young boy, and probably will be at 100. George Corey there can't refrain from that, but he's as effervescent as ever and enjoys life every second. And so I guess that keeps him from getting married, because he has no time to get responsibility. In fact, I'd like to wish he'd get more responsible. He likes to play too much. Let's see some of the things I could tell you before I get into. Of course, you probably, maybe Mr. Williams told you a lot about the conference already. We felt that overall, that I'd say probably 98% to 99% of the entire ministry actually believed and felt it was probably the best conference they had ever experienced, the best one I have ever experienced. And of course, I've been going to conferences now for about 18 years. And I felt this was the most productive, and I feel that it did more to get a handle on everybody going in the same direction than we have been for probably the last 4 or 5 years. I think the fact we now have a systematic theology, a book on the doctrines of the worldwide Church of God, and I don't know, has Earl William told you much about that? Although now he has? Okay, if he has, it's the first time the Church actually has a book that people could find out how we really believe rather than tell us what we believe. And that's been due for, you know, Mr. Ted Armstrong, as well as Mr. Herbert Armstrong, has wanted that for a good 20 years. And it took someone like Dr. Kuhn, who's very, very oriented toward detail, and who had a good staff, and as well as about 200 of us actually did projects. And it was sort of the consensus of all the projects together that actually for the first time has produced one book that anyone can pick up, you know, if they want to, and see exactly what our basic beliefs are, and all brought up to date as well. Now, you understand doctrine is nothing more than a church's pursuit for truth. Doctrine is teaching. That's all it means. It just means teaching of the church. And if anything is growing, so it means its teaching has to grow. And so therefore, our book has a three-ring binder. So it's subject to change. And if not, then it would mean that we are not pursuing or growing in truth. And so it is not something that is fixed and never changes. As you all know, the radical changes we've all experienced in the last 6-7 years. But at the present time, for our spiritual understanding, it is the belief of the Worldwide Church of God. Now, always the problem with change is no one changes at the same rate. Ministers don't change at the same rate. Laity did not change at the same rate. So undoubtedly, you're going to have some people who are not up in understanding to what the doctrinal book writes or has printed. And there are going to be a few ministers who don't. But it's basically the mind of the church as we see that God reveals it to us at the present time. And so I believe it gives us a real stabilizing factor, quite a stabilizing factor. And I think that was one of the most outstanding facets of the conference. Then the other was that there was an awful lot of education going on. We not only, of course, had the ministers attending the different lectures and seminars, but the wives registered as well. They could register separately or jointly. And so they benefited directly as well as the wives, and they almost got probably comparable to a full semester, all thrown into 11 days of just intense information from an educational standpoint. So I frankly, just the doctrinal book alone should have more sermon material, you know, than they probably can live long enough to cover. Because I could take any one of those doctrines and go on for a couple of years in the depth of new insight into it. So I really feel that it was extremely beneficial. And I think one of the crowning things was the fact that Mr. Herbert Armstrong was well enough to come and open the conference and spoke for about a half an hour, approximately that. And of course, as far as, you know, his voice and his mind and his macho, if I could use that term, it's as strong as always. His body is what's weaker. It's his legs. I had a chance to visit him 2 weeks before that in his home in Tucson, and even though he could walk around, he still basically could not, you know, walk too long. He was rather weak. But he's certainly free and has been writing. He's writing 2 books, and he's written about 4 or 5 articles even at that time. And I think he wants to write one on the human potential of man, which I thought would be very helpful. And also, there are about 2 or 3 others that he had in mind. So I think what we're going to see is a lot of writing coming out. I don't know. He's planning to make some visits this spring, you know, on his travels. But if he's that strong, that's great. But I hope he doesn't overdo it, because he is 85 years old. He's not like George Faulkner, who's 100 and doesn't look over 10. You know, he just never changes. He's perpetual in that way, I guess. That's what happens with these Scots. So, which is very good. Russians do that too. They live long. So I'll die tomorrow and change it, something of that nature. Well, we are going to do a few things. There are going to be some dramatic changes, as is always in the church. Some I can't tell you about until it happens. Because, you know, it's not more, it'll be 5 or 6 months away before it transpires, and anything that's 5 months away is subject to change. So, therefore, I don't want to tell you about it. But there will be some changes. There'll be changes in probably the college relationship the way we have it. We are trying, I want to, since in the foundation, we're going to take most of what I have in the foundation, the Human Potential Center, and put it under ministerial development. Because I want to make it more evangelical in scope. I want to be more directly responsible for local church growth. And so I'm going to try to make it more of the lectures we're doing and sponsor it under the church, so that when we go out and lecture, that the people, like we're doing a new one called Keys to Family Enrichments by Dr. George Geis, Ken Coleman, who's a psychologist, and myself, he's in the church, and we lecture together. And we're going to do one in Pasco, Washington next week. And there are about 200 outside people coming. And we've got it to the place now where we can give them all free. So there'll be free community services on dealing with life situation problems, you know, like marriage, career, family, human relationships, all biblically based but academically instructed. And then we want to try to build new lists from these people. And from these new lists, give them to the pastor. And then let the pastor of the church, anytime he has an activity, it could even be maybe if he's holding at that time a Bible study, or if he a church social, or whatever, that an announcement would go to these new lists of people. They would not be, told anything about the church as far as they have to attend church, purely just for what the church does as a humanitarian effort. Anytime we do humanitarian work, the Christian work, they would get a letter. And we believe in time that God would move some of the minds of some of them, and then it'll become more evangelical in scope. So we want to increase that and tie it in with the pastor rather than through our local chapters. So rather than have local AICF chapters, we're going to start to do our humanitarian Christian work through the local congregation under the direction of the pastor. Now, we will still have a piece tied in with the foundation when there are some activities that should be purely foundational. But most of it's going to be taken under ministerial development, and we'll probably change the division to ministerial and congregational development. So not only would I be responsible for the development of the ministry, but the development of the congregations as well. So this is going to be a considerably new thrust. I spent nearly all of last week writing up all the detail to give it to Mr. Ted Armstrong and then to discuss its implementation. So that's a change, I think, that should contribute dramatically. What really sparked the idea that I felt it's time to move it in the church was, I know for a number of years in Detroit, when we came here, we had no radio broadcast. And, of course, there wasn't any television in those days, but no radio. And we were adding a new church every 6 months. And I really began to wonder, why was it that we were increasing at a rate of a new church every 6 months? And we actually had no outside evangelical tool. And, of course, you might not remember it, but in a Bible study, I took a survey. And this was back in 1965. And I found out that 40% of the church growth at that time came through the congregation. Had no previous contact whatsoever with the World Tomorrow or the Worldwide Church of God. It all came through the church membership. So it made me understand and realize that a considerable part of the growth in the church comes right through the membership. And I'm not talking through by babies. Which is fine, you know, if God calls them when they get older. I mean adults. So I want to offer communities an outreach of the church in a local area. So we're going to start to probably test it in some areas and then make it available to pastors who would like to start to use it as a tool. So that would be a rather dramatic change that we're certainly contemplating. Also, of course, we're in the second semester now at Ambassador. And this is the largest number of sabbatical ministers we have in. We have about 35 ministers in, about 15 from the international work, and then about 20 from the United States. And it's very interesting, the sabbatical program, which was really a bad term because it's really now the certificate of the ministry, because it's anything but a sabbatical. I mean, they work their tails off. In fact, Doug Taylor, how many of you know Doug Taylor? You should know Doug. I had a jacuzzi with him the other night in his house out in the backyard. He bought a house, and he's very innovative, so he put in a one of these, you know, hot tub type of things with the jets. We call them jacuzzis. Maybe you call them that here. And we just soaked for an hour and a half together. And anyway, he told me he's never worked so hard in class in all the years he went to Ambassador as he has with the certificate program. And, of course, he extended his greeting as well. And so the men now have reversed completely. Before, a lot of the men coming in before our program used to view it sort of as something that was sort of correctional. Now it's developed such a demand, we have too many requests. For this next year, we have the highest number of requests for pastors to come in to take a certificate of the ministry program than we've ever experienced in the work. So our problem is to, you know, make sure we address it with the proper budget, you know, where our budget can stand it. So we'll probably in early spring be announcing who will be coming in and what the changes will be far as the pastorates are concerned. But I think we finally have a far more professional program for the development of the ministry than we ever have had in the history of the work. And I think a lot of specialized areas are developing, where a lot of our men now are getting specialized training in counseling, not only from the college, but even other institutions that offer training in counseling. And I think as we develop, we'll probably have a ministry that certain ones who just specialize in counseling. Before, we used to, you know, put everything all together. And one minister had to be a specialist in everything, from laying bricks to making tea. You know, you had to be, and you can't. It's an impossibility. And so we are getting more and more to the place, I think, where we'll be able to feed the sheep and serve people better. So I think that's a very good thing and a very exciting thing. Right now, of course, this usually gets to be budget time. And as usual, it's always a frightening time. Income is always, we find, is at the highest it's ever been, and yet the expenses are higher than they've ever been. So you run under the same problem. They always are having, you know, difficulties that way. The question is always, you know, the question isn't, you know, when you have about $70 million, that's a lot of money. So it isn't that you don't have money. It's the question is, how do you allocate it? It's where it should be used to be the most effective. And that's not an easy thing to decide. And then when you decide these are the areas that's most effective, then it means you have to cut it out of some other areas, and so someplace else suffers. You know, it's just the reality. And you always have to do this. It's just like in your home budget. You know, when you see that inflation is horrendous. I mean, I can't believe it. Yesterday, I bought I ran out of shaving cream, so I bought a can of shaving cream, and I needed razor blades, and I forgot my toothbrush, and I bought a toothbrush. It cost me over $5. I couldn't believe it. I mean, you know, that's not fair. I mean, it just shocks you. It really does. So it's really, you know, there's no doubt. People think houses are going to go down. I don't think so. I think we'll see the day when we're looking at houses today that, you know, the average price of a home in the United States today is $60,000 across the United States. The average price of a home in where I live is $85,000. The average home is $85,000 in Southern California. You've got to live there to believe it. And the taxes are crazy. So really, when you put everything together, it's very difficult today. And I wouldn't doubt that $100,000 homes within 10 years will be a million. I'm not kidding you. I mean, who would have ever thought you'd pay so many times a dollar for a loaf of bread? There are some health food stores, you're paying a dollar for a loaf of bread. If anyone told me I'd pay a dollar for a loaf of bread, I'd say they're losing their marbles. But you do. When you use phony money, this is what you do. We're playing Monopoly. That's all we're doing. You know, the basic cause of inflation is very simple. It's stealing. That's all it is. Not producing in direct proportion to the value of what you're charging. And it just means something for nothing. And as long as we keep doing that, we're going to have more problems. They can play all these games they're playing, but it means nothing. And of course, the government's the greatest, biggest crook of all. And I think they're sincere in being crooked. And I really think they're doing right. You know, when you get caught up with the Babylonian system, it's pretty bad. So anyway, I just thought I'd like to bring you up to date on some of the things that are developing and the place we are at the work right now. We'll probably be, you know, I don't doubt if there's a real budget squeeze, they'll probably be asking for help again. I wouldn't doubt that one bit. But who knows? You know, they say inflation 7%, 6.8 or whatever. That's a bunch of baloney. You look at the wholesale price index, and that's what the inflation rate is. And if it's up at 12 or 13%, that's really inflation. It's not the watered down figure they give you. So don't kid yourself. And you know, it doesn't take long. What is it, every 5 years at the present interest rate, your money, no, not 5 years, 7 years, I think, your money doubles if you put it in the bank. Well, if at the interest rate in the bank, which is around 5%, you know, give or take, depending on you got a certificate or not, if that doubles about every 7 years, what do you do when your inflation rate is around 10%? So it means your costs double about every 3 years. You know, that's the ridiculousness of the thing. So that's how it goes. I thought it was very interesting in the sermonette that the comment was made that Satan is insane. And the quote of the scripture in 2 Timothy 1:7, that God's Spirit, one of the gifts is to give a sound mind. What it's really saying is not only that Satan is insane, but all human beings are insane. And one of the most ridiculous, most diabolical attacks today that Satan is using with a twisted mind is against marriage. It's not only outside in society, but also in the Church of God. And the reason many people are having difficulty with their marriages and their families, it's not necessarily because of the fact that we realize that there were certain situations as far as the word porneia and fornication, which we looked at only as prior to marriage, and now realize it also includes sexual promiscuity even in marriage, to give a right for a mate to part from another mate. But the real cause of the disintegration of marriage is far deeper than that. And I found out that it is time for us to understand all the spiritual subjects in a lot deeper sense than we've ever understood before. And I've spent about the last 7 years of my life intensely researching every spiritual subject that we've ever preached about. And when we started over the years and the beliefs that we've had, they were very basic and our understanding was very limited. And whenever you use knowledge that's not very sophisticated or meaty or deep, you can cause yourself a lot of damage. And in the field of marriage itself, I realize most of our church people do not even understand marriage. They don't even know its purpose, even though we know and realize that the marriage relationship physically is a type of the spiritual marriage between Christ and the church at his return. That's very kindergarten information. But to really deeply understand marriage as it should be from a biblical viewpoint, that we as a church are negligent in our understanding, and the world has totally lost it. And that's why marriage is in jeopardy today. Marriage has a goal in its physical existence. Marriage is supposed to produce in this life, by that union, an ultimate goal that is achieved. And it's the lack of knowledge of even the goal of marriage that many times jeopardizes the marital relationship. And I want you to come to understand with a degree of depth that maybe you never understood before the actual goal and purpose of marriage that God has ordained. And I think it's probably going to shock many of you. I want you to notice in Genesis 2 and verse 18, and here's a verse that we've used in principle many times, and because we have used it in principle, we have missed its real content and intent. And we have many times spoken in reference to this verse that people should not be single. And yet there are people who should never marry in this life. Because what a marriage demands and what it requires, they do not have the capacity to give. Now let's notice verse 18. Where the Lord God said to Adam, it is not good that the man should be alone. Now, if you just take that, you take the point that he's saying, well, it's good for a man to be married. No, you've got to keep it in context. The reason in verse 17 that he said that it is not good for a man to be alone is because if you back up to verse 15, you find that Adam was given a work or a job. And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. So he received a responsibility, a physical responsibility, aside from the fact, the spiritual lesson of training he was supposed to learn on this earth. And then down in verse 18, he's saying, because of man's responsibility, it is not good for him to be alone. And then you read the latter part of verse 18, and he said, I will make him a helpmeet or proper fit for him. In other words, the reason that God said it isn't good for a man to be alone isn't because it's wrong for him to be single or for a woman to be single, but it states that he needs help to do a work. He needs help to accomplish a work. Now, if you had a responsibility or a work, and it was more than you can carry out on your own, you would naturally want to employ, or you would want to be associated with a being who would help you the best way possible, right? That's what you'd want. So God, in creating a being that would help Adam complete a purpose or a work, he created the best type of being possible. Now we're going to see as we go along what makes homosexuality or lesbianism so diabolic and so evil is the fact it is a relationship that keeps man from completion to do a work that God intended. God doesn't just throw laws out and then gives you these laws and says, I just want you to do these laws because I think they're good laws. When he gives a law, it's because he knows it is the right way it should be done. And when he brought together two beings, a male and a female, in a marital relationship, it was because it was the best way that beings could function together to do a work. Now, to ensure that, he went on and told us something that's very beautiful. And it was lost after the Garden of Eden and was not restored again until Christ came to the earth and restored it. And the reason so many people misunderstand marriage is they don't realize marriage in the Old Testament was not the same marriage that was in the Garden of Eden. And the New Testament, when Christ came and spoke of marriage, he came to reestablish what was lost in the Garden of Eden in the marital relationship. And too many times people read the Old Testament and carry on the wrong way of the way marriage should be. For what purpose? I want you to notice this in going on as he continues in verse 21. Where the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof, and the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman and brought her unto the man. Now, why did God make the woman from man? Couldn't God have created Eve from the dust of the earth just as he created Adam? Why is it necessary, or was it necessary, that he created Eve from Adam's flesh? Why is it that a woman, when she marries, must take the man's name? And you know, there's even been talk today where in the movements among women, some of them are very needful because some women have been unjustly, you know, abused and their rights have not been fair. But at the same time, some of them are distorting the actual biblical purpose of marriage. And they want to start to call the family name by the female name. And you know, there have been civilizations in the past where families have been called by the line of the woman. Why is it that God biblically insists that she take the man's name? Now, it's very interesting. In Genesis 1, it tells us, in verse 27, it tells us, so God created man in his own image. You notice he's speaking of man singularly here, as if he's just talking about Adam. This is Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Then notice, male and female created he them. He spoke of them as man. And what he was really talking about was the two sexes. And yet he spoke of it as if it was man and not a man and a woman. Now, there's a specific reason for that. Now, I want you to back up with me to Genesis 2, and notice what else he said in verse 23. Genesis 2, 23. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones. He's telling you something. And flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. And then verse 24 states, therefore. Now, whenever you say therefore, it means because of what I just said. Now, what was it that he just said? Well, he just said, woman came from my flesh, from my bone, and for that reason shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Now, the point is this. If they are one flesh, why did God decree that it was necessary to be one flesh? I mean, you go down to your work, and you know, and you might, maybe your name is John, and you go down to work, and you work right next to a guy named Mike. And you work together and do your job, right? But why is it that with God, God intended to create a mate that would be one flesh, with the man to do a work? And insisted that he leave his father and his mother, that they actually become a separate household. And it all ties in with being one flesh. What's the reason? Why did God decree that that should happen and take place? Well, I want you to notice in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 15. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 15. You better follow closely from here on, because it's going to get rather deep. Here, the Apostle Paul, of course, is talking about the relationship of fornication with the church from the standpoint of a relationship spiritually. And then he ties it in with the physical relationship. And he states, know you not that your bodies are the members of Christ? In verse 15, shall I then take the members of Christ and make them the members of an harlot? God forbid. What's wrong with harlotry? What's wrong with polygamy? What's wrong with polyandry? What is it? Why is God opposed to one man having many wives or one wife having many husbands? It's interesting in the qualifications of the ministry specifically, because evidently it was extant in the time of the New Testament. There were people who were Christians and were in the church who were polygamists. And so the requirement for the ministry was that he could only be the husband of one wife. He could not have more than one wife. And yet we find a corrupted society in the time of the New Testament where there's polygamy. And we'll see some of the very laws of the Old Testament had been corrupted, and man used some of the laws of the Old Testament to become polygamous. And God is opposed to it. Why? And here Paul is saying, if you attach yourself to someone else beside your mate, then you are attaching yourself to a harlot. And he speaks of it as evil. Now we're going to find out the reason. And it's very plain and it's very beautiful. In verse 16 he said, what? Know you not that he which is joined to an harlot is one body? That is, by consummating the sexual relationship, you literally start to develop into a one flesh relationship just like bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Just like Adam when Eve was produced from his body. And then he goes on, for two, says he, shall be one flesh. See, it comes back to the importance of it. But he who is joined unto the Lord is one spirit. So you can't even pollute yourself spiritually. Flee fornication, or porneia. Every sin that a man does is without the body, or outside the body. But he who commits fornication, or porneia, sins against his own body. In other words, there's a damage to your body. Now that's telling us something. It was interesting, when marriage was consummated in the Bible days, it was different than today in many, many ways. First, the engagement period, of course, was regarded already as a marriage. Although in the engagement period was sort of the time of investigation. So that if there was anything unclean found in the woman, and as we'll see, a woman was a piece of property. She was bought and sold. And a man owned her just like a piece of property. It was not the original intent in the Garden of Eden, but it happened that way in the Old Testament and carried on into the New Testament. And so if the woman actually was found to have something unclean during that engagement period, where the man wasn't interested, he wrote a bill of divorcement, and he didn't have to consummate the marriage. And it's exactly what started to happen with Joseph and Mary when he found out she was with child. But he didn't want to put her away, you know, divorce her. He was just going to do it privately. So he had the authority to do it. Now, the way the marriage was finally consummated, when we've lost sight with engagement periods carrying that today, engagement period is supposed to be a period of time where you really get to know each other and really see whether or not it should be a consummated marriage or not. And how it was consummated was very simple. They just had a big feast. Just like we see the wedding feast coming when Christ returns. And then the bride and groom, just like they do now, after they have a party, they go off and they consummate it or bring together the agreement to say they are becoming one flesh by the sexual act. And the reason it was so important to be a virgin was so that it would not destroy the one flesh consummation. That was the reason. Because if you had fornicated prior to marriage, you had already become one flesh. So you were actually damaging a relationship that God intended from the Garden of Eden to be the most ideal relationship that two beings could experience to do a particular work. And that's what's wrong with fornication. It destroys the one flesh relationship. It's very difficult. All right. Now, let's see why this is so important. Why so much stress placed by God on becoming one flesh? Let's turn to Ephesians 5 and verse 29. Ephesians 5 and verse 29, and you start to see very plainly why God instituted marriage and what its goal really is. And why it had to be flesh of Adam's flesh and bone of his bone, and not from the dust of the earth. In verse 29 of Ephesians 5, Paul said, "For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, even as the Lord the church." So God knew the most ideal situation whereby you can bring beings together, where there will be a unified thrust to accomplish a work done, the best that it could be done, is when it's people who are of the same flesh, because no one hates his flesh. You love your own flesh. And for love to exist in a relationship, therefore, it must come from the same flesh. And so Eve had to be created from man. And so when Adam said, "Bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh," Eve then was a part of him, which produced the most ideal relationship whereby you could have love. Because no man ever hated his own flesh. And so whenever you commit fornication or adultery, what you're really doing is breaking the relationship of one flesh. Now that's just the physical act that shows the relationship of one flesh. But what God really wants is the spiritual development of one flesh. in that marital union. And the real cause of marital trouble is very simple. And all the research I've done on it, it all gets down to one basic thing. The rules in the marriage are the problems. In other words, if a husband and a wife in a marital relationship do not function by the same rules, in that human relationship, there's going to be marital trouble. In other words, if the husband has a concept in mind of how that family should be, and a wife has another concept in mind of how that family should be, you've got a conflict of rules. So the difficulty is having a similar relationship of rules in a marriage so that that marriage could be unified and actually produce love. This is what you need. All research points to that, to the key, you know, such as sex. How often do you have sex? Rearing children. How should we rear children? Finances. How should money be handled? See, these are all rules. All rules. And the conflict comes is when both have a different set of ideas of rules. Now, the reason marriage is so destructive when it isn't performing what it was intended to perform, since you are one flesh, you are virtually eating each other up alive. And that's why the highest stress factors, the two top most stressful activities that befall man, is the death of the spouse and divorce. On any rating scale, those are the two most diabolical stresses. And so when a man and a woman, who are one flesh, are not growing toward the intended goal of marriage, which is agape, they virtually are ripping their own flesh apart. And that's why it's so destructive. Now, obviously, when you rip your own flesh apart, it's pretty hard to go to work. It's pretty hard to accomplish anything. You know, it's a funny thing, many of you know this, that, you know, if you have a career, a profession, or whatever your occupation might be, if things aren't good at home, it's very difficult for you to do well at work. Isn't it? It's very difficult for your wife to do well at home. It means that you are transgressing in your marriage, and therefore cannot be as effective in tapping what you're supposed to accomplish. So it's all that very plain and that very simple. Now let's see how the problem started at the time of the Garden of Eden and how marriage lost its real goal of growing toward agape, or love, by having this ideal situation where two beings are one flesh and no one ever hated their flesh, so there should have been and growing. Let's see how it started. It actually started with the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And this is why, where God later on tells the reward or the punishment that would befall Adam and Eve because of eating that fruit, it actually was going to damage their marriage. Let's notice in Genesis 3, and starting in verse 5, here we see the account where God, of course, said they can eat any other tree except the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And, you know, the tree of knowledge of good and evil was not a bad tree. It was a good tree. It was good just like the tree of life was a good tree. Because after we see the 6 days of creation there, that God looked at everything he made and he said it was very good. So it means the tree of knowledge of good and evil was very good. But it was misused. And God warned them if they misused it, in that day they would start to surely die. Or as the Hebrew says, dying, or process of dying. All right, now notice in verse 5. Here Satan came along, and he said something to Eve about the tree. He said, "For God does know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened." An interesting thing about Satan. You know, one thing, if you're a complete liar, everyone knows it. Can't tell. You know, there's no trouble in telling. But if you're a person who tells some lies and some truth, it's tough to tell. Now, Satan tells truth, but he perverts it. It's twisted truth. He takes truth and twists it. And that's why he is insane. All right, so when we read here, when he said, "For God knows that in the day that you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened," it was true. But in what respect? Well, notice, and you shall be gods. Now, Elohim, he, by gods, not only means almighty, but it means judge. A lot of places in the Old Testament, the word Elohim is translated judge. He says, he knows when you eat that fruit, you then will become your own judge. You will be judges, how? Knowing good and evil. You will decide for yourself what's good or what's evil. You'll become your own judge instead of God. And so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and notice, a tree to be desired to make one wise. Now, where her desire should have been was to her husband. See, if her desire was to her husband because she was flesh of his flesh and bone of his bone, and vice versa, she never would have gotten into this problem. But she looked to the tree and saw that. And so you find then in verse 7, their eyes are open, they're starting to make their own judgments. And then we go over to verses 15 through 16, and we see the result because of her taking the fruit and then Adam following along. Now notice what the result was. In verse 15, he said, "And I'll put enmity between you," this is God speaking in reference, of course, to the Satan, or the serpent, "and the woman, and between your seed and her seed," you know, the generations following, "and it shall bruise your head," finally, you know, hit and strike Satan down, win over Satan, "and you shall bruise his heel," or, you know, referring to Christ, and that he would be crucified. Verse 16, "Unto the woman," he said, "I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In sorrow you shall bring forth children, and your desire shall be to your husband." Now, it does not mean that automatically that's what she would desire. It is what she would, should be doing. "And my margin has, and your desire shall be subject to your husband." Not that it's something that it would, now women would have a desire to just be with that one flesh and be in harmony with that one flesh, but he's saying you should be subject to your husband's desire. And he, the context goes on, shall rule over you. Now, very interesting, from this point on, this was sort of the battle of the sexes from here on. And God never intended the battle of sexes, because with God there's no difference between man and woman. In the Garden of Eden, marriage originally was equal. And it's very interesting, at the return of Christ, the marriage of Christ in the church, there is no difference between male and female. They both receive the same exact reward. They both get immortality. And they both become sons of God. So it isn't a relationship of I'm master and you're slave. And the entire concept of slave and master relationship that developed was totally erroneous. And it was from this time on, and you read the account after the conception of Cain and, of course, in Abel, and then you read the Cain line and you get into polygamy, and women, you find out, purely were nothing more than property. Men ruled and mastered women. And the cultures that developed were in that relationship. Instead of marriage now becoming a relationship whereby both were one flesh, you know, all parts of my flesh are me. And I don't regard one part of my flesh as slave and the other part of my flesh as master. I love it all. And my wife is to be in that same relationship with me, because she's one flesh with me. And yet the perversion, where a woman just became a work vessel. And she literally began to be bought and sold, you know, instead of a dowry. You know, we always think of a dowry where the man would get so much money, okay? No. In the biblical days, the man had to pay for the woman, just like buying a house. The Muslims still have that belief. And it's dying out, but they still have it. I remember when I was in Egypt a number of years ago, and our guide, the Egyptian guide, he was a young fellow, about 24, and he said he had to work another about 5 years before he had enough money that he could buy himself his first wife. I mean, that's just how it was. And a woman was dealt with that way, and we've never really yet quite overcome that. We've still got that relationship. We have not been following the biblical purpose of marriage, as we're going to see as we go on. Well, it got to the place that even in Israel, when they came together as a culture, that God, in the judgments, had to even make allowances for a society that had so mistreated and corrupted the intention of marriage in the beginning, that he actually had to put in the judgments to take care of those situations. There's an awful lot about it, but let's look first in Exodus 21 and verse 1, where you're going to see an account here where God shows that a woman in that culture and in that society was nothing more than a slave. And a man owned her. And God had to have a law to take care of that situation. And so in Exodus 21:1, it states, "Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy an Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing." So here is an Israelite with an Israelite being a slave. And it's talking about the man. And in verse 3 it states, if he came in by himself, in other words, if he was single, he shall go out by himself. In other words, if he came in single and got married while he was a slave, he couldn't take his wife with him. She was the property of the slave owner. She was virtually a piece of property. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. In other words, they were one flesh in the beginning, so when they came as slaves, they stay one flesh. But if he wasn't and got married while he was a slave, he went out by himself. And now if he wanted to stay one flesh with her, what he had to do then was go to the owner and say, "I am willing to become your slave for life," and then they put an awl through his ear. That meant he was a slave for life, where we got, you know, pierced ears came from there. And meant that you agreed to be a slave for life. So he could stay with his wife because she belonged to the master. That's literally what it was. The law, the Levirate law, which was the law that if a woman had a husband who died, and her husband's brother then was obligated to marry her. Now, what developed from that law, they took that law and so abused it. Some of these surviving males would end up, and you know, there were big families in those days, 6, 7, you know, and they got married older, and so they, you know, they really went on. And sometime, this guy, he'd be the brother who had longevity, and he might have 5 wives of brothers who died. It's polygamy. It grew into polygamy. It was a very accepted thing. That's why, like Abraham and in David's day, this was part of the cultural system. And really was even extant as we went on into the New Testament. But now, notice now, Christ starts to restore the original purpose and intent of marriage. In Matthew 19 and verse 1, and they didn't understand him. In fact, the disciples didn't even understand him. It was very difficult, because if you didn't know the pure, pristine understanding of what marriage was intended from the beginning, naturally they wouldn't understand, because they were reared under Judaic law and they didn't understand the original purpose of marriage and how it was supposed to function. Well, of course, since the Pharisees didn't, they tried to tempt Christ. So in Matthew 19 and verse 3, the Pharisees came to Christ trying to tempt him and said to him, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause or for any reason?" And that's literally what they did, because she was piece property. You know, you could buy and sell your property. And that's what they did. And he answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female?" He was trying to tell them something. He was trying to explain, how can you divorce your own flesh? How can you separate yourself from your flesh? Can you peel off your skin? Can you take bones out of your body and you're in good shape? He said, from the beginning he made them male and female. And said, "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh." He's trying to explain something to them that they didn't understand. "Wherefore, they are no more two, but one flesh. And what therefore has God has joined together, let not man put asunder." Why not? Because the result of tearing apart your flesh is death. It's not life, it's not love. And it's an amazing thing, statistically, in the field of psychology. No matter how much, usually, two people hate each other in a marital relationship, where it finally gets so diseased there's no longer one flesh relationship there, mentally, physically, psychologically, or spiritually, and they divorce, even though they desire it, can't wait till they can get away from each other, they still both go through tremendous stress after the divorce. And they don't understand why. It's very simple. They saw the death of their own flesh. This is what they experienced. Then he goes on in verse 7, and they asked him another question, and this really gets down to the crux of it. They said to him, then why did Moses then command to give them a writing of divorcement and to put her away? Why did he allow it? Now notice the reason. Christ said in verse 8 unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts. When your heart is hard, it means it lacks love. It's because you were not really growing toward the goal or the purpose of marriage. It was doing just the opposite. You really, your inner being, didn't have love. And what marriage was supposed to produce or be producing is love. Because there was no love there, he allowed it to happen. And that was the corruption of the original marriage purpose. He permitted it because there was no relationship there of what that marriage was supposed to be producing. And so it happened. And then he went on. He said, in that verse 8, and he said, because of the hardness of your hearts, he permitted you to put away your wives, but notice the latter part of verse 8. Very interesting. But from the beginning it was not so. His marriage in the Garden of Eden was not so. That was not its intent. That was not its purpose. So he's trying to restore now the original purpose of marriage and what it's supposed to do. And of course it blew their minds. In fact, later on he goes on, it's very interesting. In verse 10, his disciples say unto him, if the case of the man be so with his wife, it is not good to marry. In other words, if it's that difficult, then it's not good to marry. And they're right. If a person is not at the place that as an individual, marriage problems are really never partnership problems, they're individual problems. If you cannot function in a marriage and grow in a marriage, it doesn't mean that there's just something wrong with, you know, your mate did something wrong or you did something wrong. There's something inherently wrong with you as people. In other words, you lack the ability, the skills, the maturity level to handle the responsibility of marriage. And it is very difficult. In other words, you're no different than it was in Moses' day, the hardness of your heart, whether yours or the mate's. And so it goes on very clearly. He starts to say, interestingly enough, verse 11, but he said unto them, all men cannot receive the saying. In other words, all cannot marry, save they to whom it is given. And he tells us, verse 12, for there are some eunuchs or single people who were born so from their mother's womb. They just from a standpoint of sexually can't. And there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men, and there be eunuchs which have been made themselves eunuchs or single for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to receive it or fulfill its function, let him receive it. Because they were having a great deal of difficulty remaining faithful. They'd keep committing porneia and couldn't keep that union of one flesh. And so you find there are people who basically are mentally not capable enough to be a married mate. And usually when I counsel a marriage, when people come to me, I'm not that as much interested in how they fit as mates to one another, I counsel with them individually first to see even if they are mentally sound enough to marry anyone. I remember I had, I counsel maybe about 10 or so marriage problems every week when I'm in Pasadena. And I remember this one that this marriage broke up, and they couldn't even get together for anything you bring up. They couldn't talk. I mean, I was there as a mediator, and they couldn't do it. And if I probably wasn't in the room, they might have committed murder. It was that bad. But really, I had both talked to them individually when they came to me, because they had gone to a couple of other ministers and didn't like the answers there either. And what I got down to is I very plainly told them. I said, your problem is not your marriage. Your problem is the two of you should never have married anyone. And they agreed with me. They had serious problems. As people, to handle the relationship of marriage requires very mature beings. You realize it is a divine institution. It is a relationship that is preserved for what God and the church will be. And that's why marriage suffers so much today. It's something 7 out of 10 marriages are failures. And I'm not talking about divorce. I'm talking about people who live together all their lives and are married together all their lives. 7 out of 10 are failing. That's pretty high. That's pretty high. All right, now, what's the problem behind all this? What is it that it takes in the relationship to really make something out of it? Well, I want you to turn with me to Ephesians 5 and learn maybe an insight that you never had before. I know one thing I found out church members and most ministers never understood before. In fact, they gave this lecture to the ministry as one of the lectures because I felt they needed to know. For many years, we have equated the head of the house as the same as being boss. And yet, scripturally, that's not true. When you speak of someone being boss or lord, the word is Adonai. The word head is talking about a part of your body. The head of something is not a master. The head of something has a capability. Now, it is true scripturally that the man in responsibility is supposed to be the boss, and we'll see that. But the head of the house has a totally different connotation. I want you to notice that with me, and starting here in verse 22 of Ephesians 5. You know, have you ever heard, you've heard the statement probably from time to time where the woman said, I want my husband to be the head of the house. And of course, that's even an erroneous statement because that's not what head means anyway. As we're going to see. She said, but I can't respect him. I can't submit to him. And he says, well, if she submitted to me, then I would be different. And she says, if he would be different, I would submit. And he says, if she would be different, I would, you know, be different. The point is, they are both right. When that woman is making that statement, she is not wrong. But neither is he. It's because of a misunderstanding of what they're both crying out, what their words are saying, and they don't understand their own words. Now, I want you to read, starting in verse 22 of Ephesians 5, it tells us that wives should submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord, or Adonai, or master. Notice the husband is supposed to be the one in charge. But in what kind of a relationship? You see, in the Old Testament, they corrupted the relationship. They did not understand what master meant. They thought that master meant she's a slave. And how many times have you heard a woman say, I feel like I'm nothing more than a slave in this house? She's telling you something. She is telling you something. I don't think she really knows what she's saying, but she's saying it. Because it's a very complex thing. But going on in verse 23, he starts to tell us how he's supposed to be in charge. For the husband is the head of the wife. How? What does a head do? Notice. Even as Christ is the head of the church, and a lot of times people stop right there and they say, yeah, Christ is the master, and we're the doulos, slaves to Christ. See, so the wife has got to be this slave. No, it doesn't say that. Go on, notice what it says. And he is the savior of the body. In other words, the head of the house is the benefactor. The head of the house isn't the demander, he is the giver. It's a little different, isn't it? If a woman is crying out where she wants to support him as one flesh and can't do it, it's because something is lacking. If you have a working relationship between two beings, and these two beings have a common work that they're trying to accomplish as a team, and the one can't seem to do it because of what is lacking in the other, how can the other one, who's part of the team, do their job if you don't provide your part? And so in the relationship of the responsibility, God places, since the man is supposed to be the one in charge, he says, you therefore are the head, or the one who are the benefactor, or the blessor, or the one who should be bestows all things on the wife. Now, if you get married, now just looking at some very physical things, let alone looking at the spiritual aspects of temperament, of control of behavior, which the man is supposed to exemplify the best, as Christ does. But let's just look at some of the physical things. And we used to, and still do in the churches, but pretty much, that a husband is responsible to provide for his wife. He's responsible to take care of her. He's responsible to protect her. He's responsible to nourish her. That sounds like a pretty tough job to me. It's not that easy, is it? All right, then two young people want to get married. How do they want to get married? He has no career. He doesn't even know what kind of job he's going to have. And probably he's even in debt, let alone doesn't even have a job. And this woman's stupid enough to marry him. And I think she deserves everything she gets. It's just like the idiotic thing, once in a while you'll find out a woman wants to marry this guy because he's an alcoholic and she thinks she's going to help him. Or he's a drug addict. And today we've got more and more of those problems. I'm counseling with more people with drug problems today. How? You tell me how that guy could be the head of the house. How can he be her benefactor? He needs help. I mean, really, how can that guy be as Christ, as the head of the house, to be the protector, the provider, the nurturer, the giver? How? He can't. So how can she feel like she can be a support to him to submit to get her work done? She can't. She's got to start to provide. She's got to be protector. She's got to be the nurturer. Now, I don't mean that it's wrong for a woman to work and help, you know, in a house. I don't mean it's wrong for her. In fact, if you read Proverbs 31, that's talking about a very competent woman. I don't know any women who are Proverbs 31. But I don't know any men who are Proverbs 31. I mean, those are just ideal states. They are very difficult where you're a businesswoman. You're an agriculturalist, you're a manufacturer, you can make clothes, you take care of your husband's needs, you take care of the house, you buy and sell property. But you notice very interestingly, it tells us in Proverbs 31, he also is successful. He's one of the elders of the city who sits in the gates and makes wise counsel for all the city. In other words, to have a woman that competent, you've got to be very competent. And it's very interesting, many times where I have marriage counselings, I remember even here years ago, one of the most difficult ones I'd ever have is where the woman's more competent than the man. I still don't know the solution to that problem. But the woman actually is the head. And she's going bananas because he doesn't know what he's doing. I tell you, marriage is not a simple thing. Now, the tragedy of it, we do not prepare our young men or women for marriage. And so most of them are highly ill-equipped when they get married, even in the church. Now look, in verse 24 it tells us, because the man as the house of the head of the house as the savior, the benefactor, therefore, for that reason, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. In other words, the wife is supposed to be subject to her own husband in everything because he is the savior and the benefactor or the blesser. And if he isn't the savior and the blesser and the benefactor, it's very difficult for her to be in subjection to him in everything. I mean, if you don't know how to provide and earn income and take care of the needs of the family, then how can she function and submit when she doesn't even have enough funds to function? In other words, you are asking an impossibility. Now, if you are a blessor, and you are ahead, and she still isn't satisfied, then it's her problem. Then she's the transgressor. If she's never pleased, never satisfied, there's never enough, and yet she's taken care of, the family's taken care of, he has great love for the family, great concern, he protects it, he gives it security, they are accomplished things, and she's still not satisfied, then she is the transgressor, and she's destroying the family. You see how the relationship's supposed to be? Well, that's the ideal exactly that God talks about. And that's why in verse 25, he goes on, he states, husbands, agape your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. So you see, the whole context of head of the household is the one who is the greatest benefactor or giver to that family. So if your only idea of head meant that she's supposed to do what you tell her how you want it to be, it can't work unless you're truly, as Christ said, the giver or benefactor of that house. You know, it's very interesting. You take Elvis Presley. You know, it's funny how these natural laws work. These are all natural laws. They work. It's interesting. Elvis Presley, who had a lot of problems, and yet because he was successful in one area of his life where he did very well in the field of entertainment and became very wealthy, used to receive thousands of requests from women to marry him. And they never even knew him. And I mean, they would have paid him to become his wife. And they'd write and say, I love you. I've got to have you. You see, just the fact that he was a benefactor in one area, women gravitated to him. Now, I remember when I had occasion about 2-3 years ago to see him in Las Vegas. I went with my family and a couple of friends. And, you know, he had this one act. Now they're even duplicating the act. And, I mean, just to show you how it's natural for women to gravitate to one who is a blesser. That he would get up there and he'd start doing his gyrations, and you know, when he'd really get moving, he'd really start to perspire. I mean, it was rolling down from his face, and where we were sitting, we could really see how he was sweating. And then, of course, he had all these scarves tied all around him. And you know, I remember sitting there, and of course, these women were going wild. And I turned around, this couple sitting right in back of it, and I looked at these two women, and I couldn't believe it. They were 35 years old, and they were going nuts. And I turned around and looked, and I was amazed. And of course they looked at me, and we were talking before together. They said, I grew up with him. In other words, in the 50s is when they were in their teen years, and finally, you know, and they were just ecstatic. And then what he did, he took these scarves and started to wipe the perspiration and under his arms where he was really reeking. And then they would run up to the stage, these 35-year-old women, and take the scarf and kiss it. You see, as wild as that sounds, the point is they looked to him as one who had something to give. Even though it was purely physical, it was purely just eros or emotional, it was enough. It's the explanation why I've seen so many times such beautiful women marrying such ugly men. I would always wonder, I thought, how could that woman kiss that guy who looks like an ape? You know, I just couldn't understand it. And then you find out the guy's the head of this, or is a professional, or is a successful contractor. In other words, it's easy for a woman to submit or get attached to that part, any part, which becomes a benefactor. Because that's what a head is supposed to do. Now, we look at head, we're talking about, first and foremost, spiritually. Where a woman, if she's converted, she'd be more attracted to a head of a man who is successful as in his morals, in his character, you know, exemplifying spiritually Christ. And that type of man would appeal to that type of a woman, as opposed to just on a carnal, physical level like Elvis Presley. But it shows you it is a natural law. In other words, it draws this affinity together of one flesh. Now, here's what I want to get down to on this. Since it draws you together as one flesh, and what you're supposed to become is agape, because God is love, or agape. And the spiritual purpose of marriage is Christ with the church to become God. Are we to become sons of God, or we are to become agape? So the goal of marriage, physically, in the physical relationship, is for two beings of the opposite sex, because no man hates his flesh, to have the best possible relationship to grow toward agape, or God. That's the purpose of marriage. That's its goal. Now, the error that people make in the marital union is simply this. Since our human existence is basically for the purpose of becoming something in the future, which we will never be in this life, which is God. We will never be God in this life. We must be changed to become God. It means we never will become holy agape or love until we become God. And the problem in marriage is when two people in a relationship, from the time they get married, every time there isn't love or agape between them, they blame the other. And the physical relationship is just supposed to be the training ground of growing toward love and not being love. In other words, for people to expect at the time that you get married that you are in love, God's love, is ridiculous. The love that's there, if there is any love when you get married, and frankly, I could go into that subject psychologically and show you that the majority of people who are married or got married never loved each other. But if there is any, it's usually just eros, which is emotional, or philia, which is a kinship, but not agape, because agape takes divine nature. And that's why when people living together in a marital union, when they say, well, he doesn't love me, there's no marriage here, and they break up the marriage just because they don't have love. And yet in the Old Testament, what made a marriage was simply buying her, and it was a marriage. This idea of romance did not start until the Middle Ages. Not that there wasn't romance before that, but I mean where it took on the Hollywood image started in the Middle Ages, in the Dark Ages, when the Catholic Church tried to step in and dominate because she lost her power when the Roman Empire fell. When the Roman Empire fell and society disintegrated, and people didn't have really a place of stability as the Roman Empire provided, you know, a social government that had stability. So everybody had to start protecting themselves. And that gave the rise of dukes and barons, and the whole concept of castles with a moat around it. And all the peasants lived on the land of the baron or the duke, and the nobility was in the castle with the court, and all the peasants used to have to provide, and the reason they stayed there is because it was sort of a Nimrod government. The government that came out of the Dark Ages was a Nimrod government. Nimrod, just like in his day, was the protector of the people. And so all these strong men who became the strong men who became the nobility, they would promise protection. And the ones who were astute, you know, or capable economically. What happened to my power here? And so they started playing games. And they called it knights. And they started to have their armor. And then they started, you know, this business of when he went out to get his dragon or his enemy, it was always for his lady fair. And the whole thing of Sleeping Beauty and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And Hollywood has just capitalized on the romantic era of the chivalry from the Middle Ages. And so people get married today on love that's based merely on eros or emotion. Which is not wrong to have the emotion. But to get married because of the emotion and not really understand the real true goal of marriage and the real purpose of marriage, the chances of it surviving are very small. Because unless a marriage is actually growing toward agape, it is not meeting the goal that it was intended to meet and therefore cannot stand. And that's the trouble with marriages today. You know, usually the best news you ever see, people getting to love or agape, like God's love, is usually a real elderly couple who've been married 30, 40, 50 years, and have gone through all this period of time of training together as one flesh, sometimes liking and loving each other, sometimes hating each other, sometimes wishing they weren't married, other times wishing they were glad they were married. In other words, the full experience of a human being, but because they're working toward that goal and that marriage stays together, then by the time they're 60, 70, and 80 years old, if they have been growing in that direction, they start to look alike. They not only start to look alike, they're starting to develop agape. So what I'm trying to tell you today is that marriage is a very difficult experience. And the reason it's difficult, it was created to produce the highest gift that man can possess. And if you and your marriage relationships are expecting an ideal condition in this physical life, completely misunderstand the purpose of marriage in the physical form. Just as your existence as a human being on this earth is a training ground to become a son of God, the marital relationship is a training ground of two sexes to become complete, to have the best opportunity to grow into love in the best way that's possible. And it's tough and it's hard. And you don't give up. And because we've lost that knowledge and we don't understand that knowledge, marriage is falling apart, the institution is falling apart. That's why such nonsensical talk as trial marriages, such stupid talk of just living together, because marriage was intended to be done as one flesh. And one flesh means that it's not shared with anyone else. Because no man ever hated his flesh, and no woman ever hated her flesh. And unless you keep that relationship, you will not have the possibility of coming to agape when you become sons of God in God's kingdom. That puts marriage on a little diviner plane, doesn't it? Does this give you a different insight into marriage? Does it? I hope so. Because I tell you, if you follow the way of society, and it's an interesting study I've been making lately in a subject called ethology. The study of ethology is nothing more than the study of the society's pressures on church people and what it does to their attitudes. And I'll tell you, you can get just as diseased and infected as society. Everyone is crazy. Even us. All it means is when we, with God's Spirit, if you are begotten with God's Spirit, are working to become sane. All of you have neurotic problems. And neurotic problem means nothing more than you have behavior that's extreme in certain ways. Some of you are paranoid. You're highly skeptical people. You're always doubting everything and always blaming others for situations. Some of you might even be on the border of being psychotic. Now, to take two beings who grew up in the childhood, you know, and I tell you, the more and more I get into the backgrounds of some of the people of this generation that's coming into the church, of these young people, and that I realize how many poor childhoods they've had. I thought my childhood was one that most people experienced. And I'm finding out to my chagrin it's not true. Most young people today coming up in the 50s and 60s came from wretched childhoods. It doesn't mean all. There's some fine people today, fine young people. But I'm telling you, when those people, I believe today in our culture, that as a rule, not always, but as a rule, for young people to think about marriage before they're 30 is suicidal. And that doesn't mean that people who are 22 or 23 years old shouldn't be. But our culture has so deprived the last generation in maturing. They're far more intelligent, far more knowledgeable, but they're far more inadequate as people to handle being human. They come in with mixed neuroses, and then they emotionally get involved with someone of the opposite sex and say, I love them and we want to marry, and I tell you, they almost kill each other. And the minute that the marriage isn't in the ideal state, they want to break it up. And that is not what Christ intended from the beginning. So I tell you, you young people, I tell you, you start getting yourself growing spiritually to be mature so you can handle your marital relationships. And we who are middle-aged and those of you who are older, start to work with yourselves to become sane people. Stop devouring each other. Stop intimidating each other. Stop being envious of each other. Because if you don't, you're going to rush with the rest of society and you're all going to go nuts together. Highly sophisticated society, and they're all crazy. You know, sometimes it gets pretty tough. I tell you, sometimes you get into situations and the people are so crazy there's no solution. You know what I'm talking about. And I'm not only talking about marriage. I'm talking about you go to work and you get a nut. They pull up at a traffic light and one person starts yelling, the other one gets out of the car and pulls a gun and blows his brain out. Now, that guy's... You know, if people are not supposed to be put to death because they're insane when they commit murder, then nobody should be put to death. Because they're all nuts when they murder. There isn't one person who's sane when he commits murder. Now, we have an opportunity as a people to be a light in a society that is going totally crazy. You've got to pull out away from society and away from yourself as a person and start looking to Christ as the example and start to grow as you should be growing. And this is a devastating thing today. And I tell you, I believe, and I'm very careful when I say this because I'm very careful to blame Satan for anything because we do such a good job without him. But I honestly believe Satan is attacking marriages in the church. And the family is the basis of all stable society. And you better take that to heart and work on it diligently. And I don't care what shape your marriage is in, you begin to seek help. Go to professional counselors, talk with your minister, talk to people who are succeeding in marriages, but start to straighten out those marriages, and remember, it's to produce a work to become love. And you produce that and please God, and then please yourself and please your family, and will witness the gospel of the kingdom of God before the return of Christ.